Hey, ER nerds in the D.C. area, join us and our friends from Lawfare on Tuesday, September 26th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at Hill Country in downtown D.C. for our first ever joint event, Bar Review Live, Prosecuting and Defending the Trump Presidency. We'll be joined by former White House counsels Bob Bauer and A.B. Culverhouse for an evening of spirited discussion in an informal setting. For ticket information and more details, check out foreignpolicy.com/barreview.
Yemen is a very low priority for this administration, even lower than the previous. If the U.S. wants this conflict to end, because it's beginning to create not only an awful humanitarian crisis, but even maybe some strategic problems, is the U.S. using its full leverage with the Saudis and with their Gulf allies?
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm Sharon Weinberger, Executive Editor for News, and you're listening to the ER. I'm in Washington, D.C. today, and I'm joined here in our studio by Foreign Policy's Dan DeLuce and Paul McCleary. Dan is FP's Chief National Security Correspondent, and Paul is a senior reporter covering the Defense Department and national security issues. And on the line, we have with us Ambassador Gerald Feierstein. He is Director for Gulf Affairs and Government Relations at the Middle East Institute. He retired from the Foreign Service in May 2016 after a 41-year career. As a diplomat, he served in 9 overseas postings, including 3 tours of duty in Pakistan, as well as assignments in Saudi Arabia, Oman, Lebanon, Jerusalem, and Tunisia. In 2010, President Obama appointed Ambassador Feierstein as the ambassador to Yemen, where he served until 2013. And on Skype, we have Christine Beckerle. Christine is the Yemen and UAE researcher at Human Rights Watch, investigating international human rights and humanitarian law violations in Yemen. She previously worked with the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees in Amman, Jordan, on issues related to gender-based violence and international protection. ER fans, we love hearing from you. If you have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. I wanted to start off talking today about Yemen, which is one of these topics that never seems to get nearly as much attention as I think a lot of us feel it should. Christine, Human Rights Watch has a new report out today. Can you tell us a little bit about it and what its conclusions are?
Sure. Yeah. So basically what we did with this report was that we had heard repeatedly from different policymakers that the Saudi-led coalition had promised to clean up its act. Basically, it had said it had tightened its rules of engagements and it was working to better minimize civilian harm. So we wanted to test that. And what we did was we decided to look at airstrikes since those promises were publicly reported to see, well, are there still the same sorts of laws of war violations that we've seen repeatedly throughout the course of this conflict? And what we found was that just in the last 3 months, in June, July, and August 2017, the coalition had again struck family homes, apartment buildings, a grocery store, killing or wounding dozens of children, killing or wounding dozens of civilians. And in all of these strikes, we concluded that they appeared to violate the laws of war. And the thing that is, I think, most tragic about this is none of it's surprising, none of it's new. Since the start of the conflict, we've documented close to 90 unlawful attacks or apparently unlawful attacks by the Saudi-led coalition. And we knew when we first saw the reporting that the Saudis were going to better comply with the laws of war. I was the first one to hope that that was true. But given what I had known about past Saudi practices and past Saudi empty promises to policymakers.
Ambassador, can you take us back a few years in time? You were in Yemen up through 2013. What was going on then, and what happened subsequently going into 2014 that set up the situation that we're now in?
Well, from 2011, the beginning of the Arab Spring, February 2011, until I departed, and actually well into 2014. We were in the process of implementing the GCC initiative. There were elections for an interim president, Abdurrahman Mansour Hadi, and there were a number of steps that were agreed upon among the various parties in Yemen that would not only address the immediate causes of the Arab Spring and the political uprising against Ali Abdullah Saleh, but also to try to address some of the more deeply seated issues within Yemen, the problems between North and South, the problems with the Houthis, Houthi grievances, as well as a number of other things. And so the Yemenis were working through all of these issues. There were various aspects. There was a reorganization of military and security forces there. was a national dialogue conference that was meant to address all of these issues. And frankly speaking, within that context, the GCC initiative was moving forward and it was being implemented in a pretty good way. Outside of that context, though, there was continued dysfunctionality within Yemen. The government never really came together, was never really able to take on its responsibilities. Frankly speaking, the Yemeni people were becoming more and more dissatisfied with the way this transition was being carried out. In 2014, we had the end of the National Dialogue Conference with an agreed series of recommendations that all of the parties, including the Houthis in the south, had worked on and had accepted. And we went into a constitutional reform or redesign project that the Yemenis undertook in Abu Dhabi. So all of that was going forward, but at the same time, the security situation continued to deteriorate. And beginning in the summer of 2014, the Houthis and Ali Abdullah Saleh began to cooperate on a series of measures, beginning outside of Sana'a, in Amran, north of Sana'a, and carrying through until eventually they were able to occupy the capital and begin to demand some changes in the format of the GCC initiative and the format of the government. From the fall of 2014 until the outbreak of the conflict early in 2015, you saw the situation deteriorating, the government becoming more stressed and basically under pressure from the Houthis and Saleh until finally it collapsed. And Abdurrabbo Mansour Hadi was forced to flee from Sana'a, first to Aden and then out of Aden to Oman and then to Riyadh. The situation in terms of the border, in terms of Iranian engagement, in terms of a lot of other things that were going on, deteriorated to the point where, frankly speaking, the government fled. It was in exile. The Houthis and Ali Abdullah Saleh not only occupied the capital, but began a military campaign to take control of the rest of the country. And we and the Saudis and a number of others believe that what we were witnessing was a coup d'etat, and not only in violation of the legitimate government of Yemen, but frankly in violation of an agreement that we had all worked on and all had committed to support, which led us in March of 2015 to the Saudi decision to intervene militarily.
So we get there. And Paul, can you tell us a little bit, what sort of support was the Pentagon providing Saudi Arabia and the Saudi-led coalition in March of 2015 in those initial months?
Initially, I mean, the United States had a detachment of about 125 special operations forces in Yemen at the time that was supporting the government, doing training and advising, and they pulled them out at the time. And I believe that the Obama administration was in support of the Saudi initial incursion, Saudi-led initial incursion in March, and stepping up airstrikes, things like that, in order to support the Hadi government. It was envisioned as pretty limited, I believe, at the time when it started. You know, it's been going on for over 2 years. Go ahead, Ambassador.
If I can say, because, of course, at that point I was the principal deputy in the Near East Bureau, and involved in the discussions. And fundamentally, as Paul said quite correctly, the position of the administration was to support the Saudi decision and to provide limited kinds of assistance that involved sharing the intel picture. And by saying the intel picture, I want to be clear that we never provided actionable intelligence. In other words, we never said, you know, there is a target in Sana'a that you should strike. But to provide a general understanding of the situation on the ground, we did do that.
Could I ask a question there? What does that mean? I mean, for the person listening, what is the difference between actionable intelligence and providing a picture on the ground? I mean, when sort of rubber hits the road, what is actually provided then?
Well, in other words, to provide context, to provide, you know, general understanding of what the situation was like on the ground, to give a broad picture of where the military movements were, where, you know, what was going on. But actionable intelligence is basically specifically aimed at you know, here is a target, go out and hit it.
Got it.
And
okay.
That was something that we never did. Mm-hmm. We did provide some aerial refueling support to allow the Saudis to stay up in the air longer. We did also have personnel from Central Command stationed with the Saudis at the KAOC, the Air Operations Center at Prince Sultan Air Base, that were trying to help them improve their capabilities. And this goes back to the comment that that we were discussing earlier of Human Rights Watch reporting, and that is that, you know, certainly our sense, our understanding was that the Saudi Air Force, the coalition air campaign, was certainly not meeting what we would think of as international standards. I mean, there was certainly a level of incapacity there that was troubling, and that led to many of the issues that we have, that we're concerned about, and that the international community is concerned about. And so we were there trying to work with them to help them improve their performance and their ability to ensure that the incidence of civilian casualties and collateral damage was reduced to the absolute minimum.
Well, my question for Dan then, and Ambassador, you will probably also want to weigh on this. What was, I mean, that's very sort of a tactical approach to it. We'll help the Saudis in some capacity. But what was, you know, back in March of 2015 and going forward, what was the U.S. strategy? I mean, did the U.S. hope that the Saudis would successfully push back the Houthis, Hadi would go back, and, I mean, life may not be happily ever after, but it would be back on track in terms of what was going on and the plans?
That's a good question. I think first you have to think about the atmosphere and the climate. So, you know, remember that this was deep into the nuclear negotiations with Iran, between the Iran and the U.S. and world powers. And they were very close to an agreement. And this whole negotiation made the Saudis and the Emiratis and all the Gulf countries extremely nervous, very unhappy, very anxious that some kind of tectonic shift was coming, and that the U.S. would now be moving closer to Tehran and maybe no longer sort of abiding by this kind of post-World War II arrangement. So Ambassador will be able to weigh in on this, but clearly the White House then was aware of the Saudi resentment. And so here the Saudis were coming to them saying, we've got a problem in our backyard. We'd like your help. And I think it was probably a way partly to say, you know, we have your back. We're still your ally and we'll help you. Now, I think, though, over time, some of the Saudis and the Gulf countries felt the U.S. should be doing more military assistance, more intelligence sharing and so on. And maybe more help with the whole air campaign. So I think you can weigh in on this again, but it does seem like the Obama administration was caught in between. So on the one hand, they weren't willing to sort of really have kind of full-blown, full-fledged support for the Saudis because they were fighting Islamic State was on the loose at that point. They were occupying huge swaths of territory in Iraq, in Syria. That was the immediate kind of wolf at the door. Plus, they had this nuclear negotiation. So the U.S. wasn't even really in a position to really kind of go beyond limited assistance. So this was a way of playing it. But I think the key question here would be, it's a hypothetical and you can't answer it. What if there was no JCPOA? What if there was no nuclear agreement at that point? Would Obama have said, no, I'm not really going to help you with this. I'm not confident this is going to be successful. And let's just do this diplomatically. We'll never know the answer, but you have to wonder.
Ambassador, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, that's an extremely hypothetical question.
Yes.
But what I would say, I agree that was an undercurrent in terms of the administration decision. But I would also make the point that both we and the Saudis at that juncture had very limited goals in this issue. The Saudi decision to intervene came before the total collapse of the Hadi government. And the original idea was to try to stabilize the Hadi government in Aden secure defensive perimeter, and then get back into negotiations. Before the Saudis, you know, between the time they made the decision and the time they actually intervened, fundamentally the whole situation had deteriorated to the point where Hadi was out of the country and the Houthis were driving down into the south towards Aden. And so the situation shifted very quickly. But fundamentally, the objectives for both the U.S. and the Saudis were limited to restoring the legitimate government of Yemen, not permitting, you know, that government to be overthrown violently through coup d'etat, which is what was happening, and also to secure the Saudi-Yemeni border, because for several months before this, we had seen the Houthis, with Iranian encouragement, militarily threatening the security of the border, launching, you know, military exercises, issuing a number of extremely provocative and aggressive statements against Saudi Arabia. So you know, secure the border, get the legitimate government back, not necessarily to remain. And we weren't opposed to the idea that there might be some negotiated change in the format of the government, but to do it through a process of negotiation, not coup. And finally, to complete the last elements of the GCC initiative to allow the Yemeni people to basically go to the polls and choose a government, which they hadn't been able to do for a decade. Those were the objectives, and we supported that.
Please, Dan.
That's interesting. I'm wondering, during that early stage, you said before the government fell, was there a feeling on your end that the Saudis were not being active enough? Did you want the Saudis to intervene earlier in different ways to kind of shore up the Hadi government?
Absolutely. And this was a discussion that we had with the Saudis for a number of months through those fall and winter months of 2014 leading into the spring of 2015, that we had expressed concern to the Saudis about the political situation, the economic situation that was deteriorating in Yemen, and encouraging them to be more aggressive in supporting Hadi and trying to stabilize the political situation there. And at that time, the Saudis were reluctant to become more deeply involved. They were frustrated with Hadi and Hadi's performance, and therefore, they didn't really want to get involved until they saw the situation deteriorating in a way that they felt fairly, in my view, threatened their own security.
So as things went on, so March 2015, the Saudi and coalition airstrikes start, and pretty quickly reports emerge of pretty horrendous civilian casualties. Also, there are beginning reports of the use of cluster munitions. I'm going to turn to Christine in a second, but Paul, can you walk me through particularly the reports of the cluster munitions? What happened? Why were they so controversial? And what was the pushback?
Well, the Saudi airstrikes, I mean, there were Americans not helping targeting, apparently, but in the chaos in Saudi Arabia who were assisting. And the Saudis weren't always taking all of the advice or listening to, you know, the intelligence they were being given. And they were hitting hospitals, schools, markets, funerals, as we've all seen, often using cluster munitions, you know, bought from the United States, from the UK and from other countries that would spread, you know, wide-scale devastation across targets they had hit. And also, not all of the cluster munitions explode immediately. So shepherds or children will walk by and step on them and be killed or injured months later. All of which caused pretty widespread international condemnation of the Saudi-led campaign and caused President Obama to then pull back some of the U.S. support in the operations center in Saudi Arabia. The refueling sorties continued as they continue now, but most of that intelligence, I guess, help or assistance ended, I think, in large part due to these civilian casualties.
Right. Yeah. Christine, the cluster munitions, I mean, I know that Human Rights Watch has been very involved in documenting this. The Brits pushed back heavily After reports that Saudi Arabia was using British-made cluster munitions. I believe the Obama administration finally blocked sales of further cluster munitions, I think in December 2016. Does that sound right, Paul?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I've still seen reports.
Well,
and I think,
if I could just jump in.
The
decision not to sell any more cluster munitions actually came in the spring of 2016. The decision in late 2016, following the Saudi hit on the funeral parlor, was not to sell precision-guided munitions, mm-hmm. which are different from cluster munitions.
Right. Okay. But then, Christine, if I remember right, Human Rights Watch has documented that the Saudis continue to use cluster munitions. I believe Brazilian-made ones. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the ambassador certainly has the timeline correct, but I think the reason the cluster munitions story is one both of success and frustration is because you did have the U.S. halt the transfer of cluster munitions to Saudi Arabia. And I mean, to be fair, this was after Human Rights Watch and others had documented the coalition using U.S.-made cluster munitions on our end, more than a dozen attacks. You have the U.K. pushing back strongly against the Saudis' use of British-made cluster munition, and the Saudis coming and saying, okay, actually, you know what, we will not use this specific type of cluster munition anymore in Yemen. And that was in late 2016. So immediately following that, Human Rights Watch documented a cluster munition attack in northern Yemen. This time they used Brazilian-made cluster munitions. A few months later, both Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International documented further cluster munition attacks, again, using Brazilian-made cluster munitions. But the point of the matter is, if I promise someone I won't punch them with my left hand and then I punch them with my right hand, I'm still injuring them and I'm still not living up to the reason why people have pushed back against my actions in the first place. And I think one of the things that's really struck me with cluster munitions is we've also done a lot of work on Houthi Saleh forces' use of anti-personnel landmines, which I think it's pretty easy for people to understand why anti-personnel mines are bad, because they stay long after a conflict and they make it hard for civilians to return home, for humanitarian aid to get in, and they wound or kill civilians indiscriminately. But the fact of the matter is, the coalition, whenever we talk about Houthi Saleh use of landmines, that's covered in all the Gulf media outlets. However, cluster munitions, as you guys were describing, they do something similar where if those submunitions don't explode, they stay around and basically act as de facto landmines long after a conflict ends. And so the reason we push so hard on cluster munitions is, one, many, many countries across the globe have come together and agreed that nobody should use cluster munitions ever. And two, the way in which the coalition has used cluster munitions in Yemen has in fact led to civilian casualties, has in fact, the one we documented in December was near two schools. The one we documented in March wounded two boys on a farm. So it's really, you're talking about, those are the immediate injuries, but these are the sorts of weapons that can cause injuries long after a conflict ends. And just one other thing, in terms of airstrikes, and to go back to a little bit about what the ambassador was saying in terms of U.S. support, one thing that I've never really understood in terms of the U.S. positioning, and maybe he can elucidate, is that there's been a lot of focus on what intelligence was shared. Was it targeting intelligence? Was it actionable intelligence and all of this? But the fact of the matter is, if you're doing the analysis on a legal liabilities sort of front, refueling of coalition jets on bombing missions can also lead to the U.S. itself to being a party to this conflict, to potentially aiding and abetting coalition war crimes, under a variety of analyses that have gone out over and over throughout the course of this conflict. And yet refueling continues, and yet arms sales continue, despite the fact that Human Rights Watch has documented 23 attacks where coalition cluster munitions or U.S. cluster munitions or U.S. other sorts of weapon systems have been used in apparently unlawful attacks. We've documented, like I said, close to 90 apparently unlawful attacks in Yemen. And this is really a fraction, likely, of the attacks that the coalition has conducted that should raise red flags. And yet on the U.S. side, we've still seen basically no transparency at all in terms of what they're doing to track whether or not their own weapons are being used in these unlawful attacks, what they're doing to track whether or not the jets that they're refueling, be they Saudi or Emirati or anybody else, on missions in Yemen have then gone on to attack a school, a hospital, a market, a home. The one time I ever saw public reporting about refueling and what the targets were was that the U.S. said definitively it did not refuel coalition jets on the day the funeral hall in Sana'a was bombed, that the U.S., rightly so, came out strongly and said this was unacceptable and we're going to review our support to the Saudi-led coalition. But here we are, months later, and as far as I know, refueling continues, transparency still is lacking, and without that transparency, it becomes very hard to say that the U.S. has not been complicit in any of these many, many attacks that we and others have documented. And so on the U.S. side, talking back on the history of the war and to hear about the ways in which they tried to limit that support to the Saudis, it still leaves open the question, okay, but the support that you are decided to provide and are still providing leaves U.S. individuals open to potential legal liability for coalition war crimes in Yemen. And I think that's a big question that has really not been given enough airtime, nor, at least from what I can see from the outside, that the U.S. government has not put forward at least a public rationale for why they think that this is worthwhile, particularly when all of the objectives that they either say they were supporting the coalition to achieve in Yemen have really not been achieved. The border's not secured. The Yemeni government is not in power. Houthi Saleh forces still control large swaths of the territory. And the situation for Yemeni civilians, both humanitarian-wise and in terms of the space for civil society to operate or just the effects of war, has become far, far worse.
Let me pick up on that.
If I can just jump in very quickly on the issue of U.S. refueling. My understanding is that U.S. refueling of coalition aircraft is limited to defense of the Saudi-Yemeni border. I don't believe that the U.S. is refueling aircraft that are involved in any of the penetrations of Yemen that go beyond the border area.
There's an issue with transparency there, too.
Does the Pentagon make that distinction when you've spoken to them, Paul?
They don't. And up until recently, if you asked the U.S. Central Command or the Pentagon how many refueling sorties they have flown to support Yemen operations, they would give you a number. They would give you how much they've spent, how many sorties there have been, and how many gallons of fuel they've pumped. Just recently, they stopped doing that, and they won't release the number, and they're saying they're folding in the Yemen operations into the Horn of Africa operation. So they'll give you a number for the Horn of Africa, how many refueling sorties have been flown there, which doesn't give you really any sense of what they're doing in Yemen.
Right. So they're not even giving you the total number of refueling flights in Yemen now, let alone whether there is this distinction. It may be, Ambassador, but it sounds like the Pentagon isn't giving insight into those numbers or where they're designated.
Right. I don't disagree with that. And I think it would be worthwhile for them to be more direct in responding to that. But that's what I've been told.
Right. Well, that's interesting. That'd be something for us to follow up on. Maybe a broader question, and anyone can jump in here. You know, so we're now over 2 years into the Saudi-led coalition of its airstrikes and its intervention in Yemen. And two things seem very apparent. One is that I don't think anyone argues, to include Saudi Arabia, I mean, this is a humanitarian catastrophe. The reports of, you know, malnutrition, of sickness, of illness are pretty wide, of civilian casualties are widespread. And then the second thing, and maybe someone would disagree with this, the Saudi coalition has not been successful. The Houthis are still there. Hadi, if anything, too, I think has been pretty delegitimized, even among parts of the population that don't support the Houthis or are very much against the Houthis. Maybe there's some disagreement there. What, Ambassador, what should be the strategy now? I mean, what should the U.S. do?
Well, it's a $64,000 question, and I think that you're absolutely right in saying that nobody disagrees with the fundamental point that you've made, which is that that this conflict has dragged on far longer than anyone anticipated, certainly more than anyone wanted. I know from my own conversations going back to when I was still in government that the Saudis, I believe, would welcome a way out of this conflict. And we've seen quite recently some reports of comments that the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has made to to American interlocutors, reiterating that point. I believe that he's speaking truthfully when he says that Saudi Arabia would like to see an end to this. I think that there are two components to this. One is that the humanitarian situation needs to be addressed urgently. The UN has put a couple of proposals on the table regarding the port of Hodeidah, which is the entree port for about 75% of the Yemeni population in the north, as well as reopening Sana'a Airport, which is the lifeline for thousands and thousands of Yemenis. And so they have proposed that both the port and the airport be turned over to neutral third parties and allowed to operate. The coalition and the Yemeni government have said yes. The Houthis have said no, and primarily, I think, because for the Houthis, the money that they collect in the port of Hodeidah is really what is financing their conflict. So I think that we need to put more pressure on them and those who support them to get them to do more to try to address this humanitarian issue. The other aspect on the humanitarian side is to get the central bank working again, because the irony here is that there's not necessarily a shortage of food and other necessities in the markets in Yemen. What there is a shortage of cash for many Yemenis to purchase those necessities. And that's because 25% of the Yemeni population is dependent in one form or another on payments from the central bank, and the central bank is not functioning. So we need to get the central bank working again to get cash into the economy so that people have the ability to go out and buy what they need. That's one side of the issue. The other side of the issue is to continue to press on all of the parties to go back to the negotiations. This is where Ismail, old Sheikh Ahmed, has been working very hard for the last year. We thought, the Saudis thought, I think that there was a general sense in the middle of 2016 that we were close to an agreement on a formula for ending the conflict and getting back into a political track. It didn't work. We're now well over a year after the end of those negotiations. We need to get back, and we need to finish that, allow the parties to go back to Sana'a. In terms of the Hadi government, I think it's important that we maintain the principle that there should not be a result of a coup d'etat that leads to political change. But that doesn't mean that there can't be a negotiation and a resolution through political dialogue that allows for some change in the government. But the critical factor is that, again, the GCC initiative is nearly finished. There are only a few steps left in the context of that initiative that need to be taken before we can finish this transition period and allow the Yemenis to go back and decide for themselves who they want to govern them, who they, you know, what kind of a system, what kind of a government structure they want. And we need to finish this transition period and allow the Yemenis to get back to that, you know, fundamental aspect of democratic self-government as quickly as possible.
Dan, did you want to weigh in there for a second?
It's interesting. I mean, there was this sense that maybe they were going to cut a deal in last year. And in fairness, I think most people would say that the Obama administration put a lot of effort into that. Secretary Kerry put effort into it. And now you don't see that with the Trump administration. In our reporting, I think Paul and I couldn't find any kind of sign of a serious diplomatic push going on. And never mind the fact that there are several positions that are not filled in the upper levels of the State Department that would be dealing with that. And there's no ambassador to Saudi Arabia, by the way. So there's that aspect.
But there is an ambassador to Yemen.
Yes, there is.
Who is located where?
In Jeddah.
Yeah. Okay. And, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, and there's no assistant secretary for the – but anyway, beyond the empty seats – Yemen is a very low priority for this administration, even lower than the previous. And you have to ask yourself, if the U.S. wants this conflict to end, because it's beginning to create, you know, not only an awful humanitarian crisis, but even maybe some strategic problems, maybe the U.S. is the U.S. using its full leverage with the Saudis and with their Gulf allies? I don't know. That seems to be an open question. And as someone was telling me who used to work in the government, they said, what if the U.S. just went to Riyadh and said, we are ready to pull the help that we're giving you. We're not going to give you this assistance anymore. What would that mean? It does seem like there's been this disconnect where the U.S. Would speak to the Saudis and say, let's wrap this up. Let's have a diplomatic end to this. And then here we are, and the bombing continues. And you're right about the a good example of this whole situation is this port in Hodeidah, where they desperately need to have reinstall these cranes that were bombed by Saudi jets. And since January, there's been this plan funded by USAID where the World Food Program would install these four cranes. And the Saudis have said no. And just recently, last month, the UN ambassador, Nikki Haley, met with the Saudis and the coalition, and they got a no. And so you have to ask, how does this U.S.-Saudi relationship work, and what is the U.S. leverage here? And how far is the U.S. willing to tolerate what are possible war crimes, that worst outbreak of cholera in the modern era? I mean, it's pretty horrendous.
Well, if I can just say, first of all, I agree entirely with your point that it would be worthwhile for Secretary Tillerson and other senior U.S. officials. David Satterfield is now the acting assistant secretary in the Near East Bureau. David is an extremely experienced and very knowledgeable officer. It would be good for him to be more deeply engaged. Matt Tuller, who's been our ambassador since 2014, is still on the case and working as hard as he can to try to push things forward. But you're absolutely right that it would be good for the administration to demonstrate a more focus on the Yemen situation. But the problem that I have here is that all of the conversations, and not just this conversation, but more broadly, is all about putting pressure on one side of the coin. And frankly speaking, not the side that started this whole thing. We don't talk about the need to put more pressure on the Houthis.
Ambassador, if I may, for 2 years, the Houthis have been, I mean, Yemen has been, to say there's no pressure on them, I mean, there have been over 2 years of airstrikes on them. I mean,
there's no political pressure. I mean, if we're talking about going to Riyadh to tell the Saudis to cut it out, well, the Saudis, again, you know, I think in our view, had legitimate concerns.
Can I come in here?
I'm sorry?
I want to come back to a couple of things you said about Hodeidah and Sana'a and the impediments on humanitarian aid, if that's okay. Just really quickly, I think it's totally fair. I'm the first one to critique the Houthi Saleh side in terms of their interference with humanitarian aid. We've looked at them not allowing food into Yemen's third largest city. We've looked at the pressure they've put on humanitarian agencies in the areas under their control. But to argue that the coalition has said that, well, let's just give Hodeidah port or Sana'a airport to a neutral third party, well, they're acting in good faith, and the Houthi Saleh side is acting against that. That's not acting in good faith, because two things. One, I don't mean to keep rattling on about international law here, but the requirement to facilitate the prompt and unimpeded flow of aid into the civilian population is not it's not subject to negotiation. That's on both parties at all times. And the way in which people are talking about it in the Yemen policy context is, okay, well, you know, we can't solve these problems. We can't solve the problem of the cranes. We can't solve the problem of the airport because that's subject to political negotiation. And we're trying to work out a deal between the Houthi Saleh side and the Saudi-led coalition. But the fact of the matter is, international law, it doesn't matter what the other side does. You have to follow your own obligations. And on Hodeidah port and the airport, I mean, first of all, has the UN said that they're willing to take on the control of a large commercial port or a large commercial airport or any neutral third party? And of course, the Houthi Saleh side has said no. That's unsurprising. And I'm not saying that what the Houthi Salicide is doing in the areas under its control is good. No, in fact, we know we've documented them interfering with humanitarian aid, but that does not change the fact that the coalition has imposed arbitrary and excessive restrictions on the ability of goods to get into the country to the populations that need it. And not just goods, they've also blocked journalists and human rights organizations from getting into areas under Houthi control for many, many months. And the reason I'm sort of intervening here is because the reason that we talk about people putting pressure on the Saudi-led coalition is because there's one side to this conflict that the U.S. is refueling planes for, selling weapons to, has a very close relationship with, and is clearly susceptible to U.S. pressure. So there's one side where there's an ability for the U.S. to play the role of the good guy. There's an ability and an opportunity for the U.S. to push finally for better outcomes for Yemeni civilians, but they're not taking that. And the response always is, well, the Houthi Salicide also commits violations. Of course they do. And of course we document them. And of course we call for pressure to be put on them by anyone who has communications with the Houthi Salicide. But when we're talking to the U.S., when we're talking about U.S. policy, we're obviously going to be focusing on the coalition because that's the side the U.S. continues to support. That's the side the U.S. has leverage over. And that's the side the U.S. has elected to continue to support quite blindly, it seems, in that, okay, you can have as many private advocacy meetings as you want, but if the Saudi-led coalition won't allow the cranes you funded to get into Hodeidah port, if the Saudi-led coalition is going to continue to use your weapons in potential war crimes, at what point is stronger action going to be taken on the U.S. side to make clear that it's unacceptable?
Well, I would say, first of all, that the U.N., which put the proposal for Hodeidah and Sana'a Airport on the table, I think has certainly signaled that either they or, you know, they would facilitate the identification, whether or not the UN is the most appropriate organization to provide the third party, neutral third party, or whether there's some other. I know that some people have suggested that there might be Yemenis groups or individuals who might be recruited for this position. But I do think that if there's agreement on reopening Hodeidah and Sana'a Airport, then in fact the requirement to identify an appropriate third party would be feasible. I come back to the basic point. It wasn't the Saudi-led coalition that initiated this conflict. It wasn't the Saudi-led coalition that tried to overthrow the legitimate government of Yemen and interfere with the political transition that all of the parties had agreed to in 2011, including the Houthis. And so to say that, you know, that therefore we should, you know, pressure the Saudis because they're the ones that we can pressure and not address the issue that it was the Houthis who initiated this conflict. It's the Houthis who keep this conflict going. It's the Houthis who have refused to allow this political transition to be completed. So do we talk to the Saudis? Absolutely. But the Saudis have been clear, and again, I go back to the point, the Saudis have been clear at least since the spring of 2016 that they are ready to support a political resolution of this conflict. They are not the ones who are the obstacle to this resolution. It is, you know, I think that you have to go back and you have to look at the role of the Houthis and the role of Ali Abdullah Saleh. And frankly speaking, we should be, or if not we directly, others should be speaking to the Iranians and pressuring them to put pressure on the Houthis to come to a political resolution. Not to say that the Houthis are wholly so own subsidiary of the government of Iran. I don't believe that they are. But there's no doubt in my mind that the Iranians have the capacity to go to the Houthis and say, look, the time has come for you to negotiate an end to this thing.
Right.
So the Iranians are providing weapons. The Iranians are providing IRGC and Hezbollah advisors to the Houthis. They can also be responsible for trying to end this conflict and addressing the humanitarian crisis.
Dan, I think you wanted to bring up something about the Iran issue.
Yeah, I think that it is interesting to bring up Iran because that's been a kind of looming factor in the equation, right? And so the Saudis were panicked somewhat, I think, that there could be this kind of Hezbollah-type phenomenon on their border. And the Trump administration is obviously extremely focused on Iran, even more than the last administration. And they have a different approach. They don't like this idea of some kind of diplomatic dialogue, either through the nuclear agreement or not. And so you have to wonder whether things might get worse in Yemen. Because if the Trump administration starts to raise tensions with Tehran, how is that going to play out in places like Yemen, where there's this kind of wider kind of power struggle going on between Iran and the Saudis and the Gulf countries? And then the other thing I wanted to say was, speaking of Iran, maybe they've won. Maybe they are the winner. An article quotes Bruce Rydell, the former CIA officer who advised several presidents, that, you know, really Iran at the moment has emerged as the winner in this, if you want to take a cynical view, because they haven't had to put much skin in the game. But they see their adversaries, the Saudis and the Emiratis, you know, bleeding and spending huge sums of money on this. And it is not going well militarily at all. They are not making progress. It's a stalemate. And you don't see very imaginative approaches to the diplomatic solution. We can debate where the share of blame lies. But you have to wonder, the longer this goes on, for the sake of sort of the U.S.-Saudi relationship and some other goals, is there wider strategic damage done that Iran ends up actually benefiting? You know, they've secured the Assad regime in Syria. They've kind of helped fight off the Islamic State in Iraq. Iraq is considered an ally for Iran in some ways. And now they see the Saudis kind of flailing in Yemen. You have to ask where this is going.
Probably not good places. And on that, we are out of time. Ambassador Christine, thank you so much for joining us. And again, ER fans, we love hearing from you. If you have episode ideas or comments, you can email us at erpodcast@foreignpolicy.com. Thank you. You've been listening to Foreign Policy's The ER Podcast. I'm Sharon Weinberger, and I've been your host. The program is produced by Katie Gardner and Brandon Martini. For more information about FP and to subscribe to The ER and our Global Thinkers and Backstory podcasts, please visit foreignpolicy.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you very much for joining us.